Morning. We have three cases today, starting the October oral arguments, and our first is 10AP2597CR, State of Wisconsin versus Dennis D. Lemoyne. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Lemoyne is Assistant State Public Defender Katie York. Ms. York.
Thank you. May it please the court, there are three issues before the court today. The first issue is whether or not Mr. Lemoyne involuntarily gave his statement based on the totality of the circumstances. The second issue is whether or not using his involuntary statement at trial was harmless error. And the third issue is whether or not the court could use his testimony at trial in the harmless error analysis. First, Mr. Lemoyne did not give a voluntary statement. When he was interrogated, he was 22 years old, almost 23. He was a high school dropout. He did obtain his HSED, but when he was in high school, he got mainly D's and F's, except for his auto and shop classes. He was very naive about the criminal justice system, although he had minor contacts with the criminal justice system, such as a window tint violation. I believe he had previously talked to Lieutenant Stoddard once or twice before. A few other contacts that we're not really sure about from the record. He had never been interrogated before. He had never been arrested or charged with a crime, convicted of a crime, or had an attorney represent him in this type of situation before. So he was inexperienced with the criminal justice system. It was very clear that he had a strong fear of jail. He was very afraid of going to jail, and he was very afraid of losing his job if he did go to jail. The job that he had while he was interrogated was as a truck driver. It was the best job that he ever had. He was making the most money that he had ever had, and he was very concerned about losing his job. And it was those vulnerabilities that Lieutenant Stoddard played into. He magnified his fears. He told Mr. Lemoyne during the interrogation that there were three options. First, he could be arrested and taken to jail. Second, he could get a citation and come back down the road. Or third, they could just wait and see what happens. Mr. Lemoyne's response was that he wanted a citation, and Stoddard right away told him, you don't have a choice. But later on in the interrogation, he changed his story, and he essentially gave him a choice. He said, if you tell me the true story today, basically, if you admit to the allegations, then we will not take you to jail tonight. And then he said, you know, if you don't go to jail, you will have the chance to contact an attorney and get all your ducks in a row. And he also said, if you do get locked up, then it limits what you can get. And Lemoyne asked what that meant. He said, you're not able to make any phone calls at the jail. Now, that's a big problem, because at this point, Lemoyne is inexperienced with the criminal justice system. He's not familiar with the process, and at no point is anyone telling him that he has the right to an attorney. And also, it's not true. If he is taken to the jail, he can make phone calls. Whether or not this jail does it a certain way with collect calls or certain times or whatever it is, he can make phone calls and he can contact an attorney.
So what does voluntary mean in this sense, as used in these cases of being a voluntary statement?
Well, I believe in this case it's a situation where Lieutenant Stoddard overcame Mr. Lemoyne's ability to make a rational, reasonable decision. In this case, I believe he was making a decision about whether or not he wanted to go to jail. He was misinformed about what would happen if he admitted to the statement. As far as Mr. Lemoyne knew, he would be arrested, he would be taken to jail, he would be taken to court the next day, and he didn't have any right to an attorney, and he had no way of contacting an attorney from the jail. That's what he knew.
Now, the trial court found that it was voluntary, but it was a close case.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And the Court of Appeals said, well, we're not going to deal with whether it's voluntary or not. We're going to just say it's involuntary and then say, hey, doesn't matter.
Right.
The easiest way for a court to deal with this is to just say it's voluntary, and that ends the case, right?
Right. Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So what about if it's involuntary? Does that end the case?
No.
Okay. What happens?
Involuntary, then the Court of Appeals did a harmless error analysis in this situation. Basically, the court has to determine whether or not this error, beyond a reasonable doubt, whether or not it contributed to the verdict. In this case, we know exactly what contributed to the verdict because the jury told us. They asked three questions when they were deliberating. The first one was whether or not they could see the interrogation with Stoddard and Lemoyne, which they did see. And then they asked about intent. And then they asked again to see the interrogation where Mr. Lemoyne was explaining the young girl on his lap. So they told us exactly what contributed to the verdict. It was this incriminating statement. Beyond that, the court should look at several different aspects of the case, including the frequency of the error. In this case,
I'm a little confused. I agree that sometimes when you do a harmless error, you look at the various aspects, and they stem from Billings and have brought forth. But what about Harrison Anson? Isn't that a problem in this case? I mean, isn't that an analysis we do before we get to harmless error?
Correct.
I mean, how does Harrison Anson fit in?
Correct. So in this case, the Court of Appeals, when they were doing the harmless error analysis, they also relied on and cited to Mr. Lemoyne's testimony. The problem with that is first we need to decide whether or not his testimony was a fruit of the inadmissible statement, whether or not he would have testified anyway, and whether or not he would have testified in the same way. There's a little bit of a confusion about exactly who makes that determination, whether or not it's the circuit court or the Court of Appeals. In this situation, either way, I don't believe the state can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he would have testified the same way.
There's a discussion about the Harrison Anson review. Is that, whether it's done by the trial court or the Court of Appeals, is that done on the record, already finished, or do you take evidence like you do in a Bangert hearing?
No, that aspect of Middleton was overruled. It is a paper review only. The trial court would not be able to consider any sort of feelings they had about the case that is not exactly on the record. So that's why it seems like it could be a reviewing court. The reviewing court could make some sort of determination on it, but there cannot be an evidentiary hearing on the issue.
So it's all a fiction.
Yes.
The Court of Appeals or trial court has to say, what would a defendant have done if the trial court had suppressed,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Would he have testified? Wouldn't he have testified? They don't ask the lawyer. The lawyer had recommended a different strategy. They don't ask the defendant, would he have wanted to testify? They sort of make it up as they go along, right?
Correct. It's pretty much speculation on what he would have done. But in this case, obviously, the state used his statement throughout the case. I mean, they talked about it opening. They talked about it in closing. It was throughout Lieutenant Stoddard's testimony. They used the video. They used the transcript.
Well, that goes.
So Lemoyne had to testify.
Yeah. But as the state points out in its brief, other than his testimony, they would have rested on nothing other than cross-examination because there were no other witnesses, right?
Correct.
Any of the medical testimony, the nurse or the mother, that would have gone in the state's case and would have had the defendant would have had to depend on cross-examination to raise doubt.
Correct. Or he could have testified. He may have testified in a different way.
Yeah, Once he took the stand and testified in a different way, couldn't they have used his statements?
They could not use his anything that was inadmissible. So the where he's actually admitting after the promises made, after Lieutenant Stoddard misled him, everything after that is misled and it can't be brought up on cross-examination. It's not like a Miranda violation. The beginning part of his interrogation could have been brought up. I think there are some differences between what the cross-examination would have looked like. I know there was definitely a point where the Attorney General was cross-examining him about the different version at trial about his accidental touching. I believe he testified that the girl jumped up on him and slid down his arm, whereas during the actual test or during the interrogation, he said that the young girl sat on his lap and he was cross-examined about this. This would not come in if the statement was inadmissible because it's during the tainted portion of the interrogation. So the beginning of the video, yes, that he could be cross-examined on it, but not the tainted portion.
What about in rebuttal?
In rebuttal? Whether or not the tainted portion could be used?
It can't be used in the case in chief.
Right.
And it can't be used in, you're saying it can't be used as cross-examination.
Right. So once it's deemed involuntary, it can't be used. So it's not like a Miranda violation where if he testified, then the state could use that as material during cross-examination. That doesn't happen if the statement's deemed involuntary.
Ms. York, do you want us to do the Harrison-Anson analysis, or do you think that this should go back to the circuit court?
Honestly, I think the circuit court is probably the best court to do it because they were the ones that presided over the trial. However, whether it's this court or the circuit court that makes this decision, I don't think the state can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he would have testified, and he would have testified in the same manner. And regardless of whether his testimony is considered, I believe that this is not a harmless error case, regardless whether or not the court considers his testimony and whether or not, or whether they do not consider it.
Well, can a court get to the harmless analysis without doing the Harrison-Anson analysis here?
Well, I guess presumably if the court decided that it didn't make a difference either way, the outcome would be the same, the court could make the analysis, but if it's something that the court found to be a determining factor, I think that decision would have to be made first.
Okay, the Court of Appeals here did not engage in that analysis, is that right?
No, I believe when I filed a motion for reconsideration, they said they considered it and rejected it, but nothing was discussed regarding this issue in the opinion.
But they did recite the fact that they had considered this analysis and rejected.
Yes, after I did the motion for reconsideration on this issue, yes.
In the totality of circumstances for voluntariness, how important, in your view, are the personal characteristics of the defendant?
Well, I think because it's a balancing test, it really depends on what the coercive conduct is and compared to what the characteristics are. So, for instance, in Hoppe, you have a defendant that's in the hospital, has a decreased mental state. So there was a very slight coercion in that case, and that made it involuntary. Now, I think we kind of balance it a little bit more here, but the coercion is more here. So I think it depends on what the coercion is from the police, which then impacts how naive or inexperienced or vulnerable the defendant is. In this case, I think it's very important that the specific vulnerabilities he has, namely that he's not very educated, that he's inexperienced with the criminal justice system, he doesn't have any experience, you know, being arrested, going through the court process. That's very important because that's exactly what Stoddard is misleading him about. He's telling him, number one, that he can't contact an attorney in the jail, and he's not telling him that he has a right to an attorney. He's also telling him that he can come back in up to 4 weeks if he doesn't go to jail, and he can he'll come back for that initial appearance, say, I'm not guilty, but the best thing you can do is go talk to the DA so it doesn't end up in court. It doesn't end up in the public forum. I mean, the only thing that means is it won't end up in court if you go talk to the DA. Like, that's not an actual possibility. I mean, I guess it could be a possibility. It's not a realistic possibility. So really he's misleading him directly, and it's directly linked to his personal vulnerabilities. So I think that's what's important in this situation.
What import, if any, should we place on the fact that he had a cell phone on his person during the interview, and in fact a call came in, and the officer said you can answer it, and he said no, he didn't want to, in regard to his arguments to us that his phone calls would be restricted?
Okay. Well, first, I believe it was actually a text message, not a phone call.
Okay.
And Stoddard said that he could respond to it, but at the end of the day, Stoddard told him, when we take you to jail, you can't make any phone calls. So obviously, he's not going to be able to take his phone with him to the jail and use it, because Stoddard's telling him you can't make any phone calls. And that's the problem, I think, in this case, one of the many problems in this case. And I also think it's a little unrealistic to think that he could have just dialed up an attorney right then and there in front of Lieutenant Stoddard. But at the end of the day, he was saying, I can take you to jail if I want. I have enough to arrest you. And if I arrest you and take you to jail, you cannot make any phone calls. And that's the problem.
Counsel, I'm reading the Court of Appeals order on reconsideration, which is at 125 of your brief. And it says as follows. Appellant Lemoyne moves for reconsideration of our decision. Lemoyne raises Harrison for the first time in his motion for reconsideration. And then here's the sentence. In any event, we have already addressed and rejected Lemoyne's Harrison argument by holding that any error was harmless. So from, I read this to say that, hey, you can avoid the Harrison-Anson issue by just looking right to harmless error. And then once they find that the error was harmless, they don't have to do Harrison.
Well, I guess that would be true if they didn't rely on his testimony. The problem here is that they cited his testimony in doing their harmless error analysis. It was
well,
one
then
of the
you're saying they didn't apply the right harmless error test.
Correct. Correct.
So your view is that if had they applied the correct harmless error test, then they didn't have to do Harrison-Anson?
Well, I think it's a separate part of the analysis. If they chose to do the harmless error analysis and just not do the Harrison analysis and just ignore his testimony and still look at harmless error and make a decision without his testimony, then I guess conceivably they could.
Well, but there would have, without his testimony, been sufficient evidence to convict. Right?
Correct.
That's not the harmless error test, though. The harmless error test is
whether or not, beyond a reasonable doubt, the error contributed to the verdict.
Well, and depending on how you state the harmless error test, one way of stating it is that the evidence that was erroneously admitted had an effect on the jury, and that without that evidence, the jury could have or would have, that's another issue, done something differently. And the state has a very interesting and good discussion, in my opinion, on harmless error. So I'm not sure what are you asking this court to do? First, you're asking us to say it was involuntary.
Right.
Because if we say that it was voluntary, the end.
Right. Correct.
All right, that it's involuntary. Then what are you saying? We should do a Harrison-Anson test?
Yes. Yes. Although I do believe, regardless of whether or not you consider his testimony, it's still harmless error. So I would ask the court to do a harmless error analysis and make a determination on a Harrison-Anson issue or send it back to the circuit court. But I think at the end of the day, whether or not his testimony is considered, it's still going to be harmful.
Help me with this, if you will.
I thought analytically, before I got to harmless error, I had to engage in the Harrison-Anson analysis. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's correct. I think that's correct. If, but I guess my point is that if you don't engage in the analysis, if you just take it out of the equation and you do the harmless error analysis and you think you can make a decision saying that it's harmful, then you don't need to consider whether or not his testimony can be considered. So if it's so harmful that whether or not his testimony can be considered, then you can do the harmless error analysis without it. However, if you're thinking that potentially it is harmless, you still need to consider the testimony. That makes, I guess that's kind of confusing.
Because the way my mind works, it is kind of an analysis. It's boom, 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 boom.
Yes.
That's what I tell my law clerks. Boom, 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 boom. So I want an analytical framework.
Okay.
Well, sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't, you know. What's the analytical framework here? First question is voluntary.
Right. First we go to voluntariness, whether or not it's voluntary. Then we'll look at his testimony. We'll determine whether or not we can say beyond a reasonable doubt he would have testified, still testified if the statement came in, and whether or not he would have testified the same way. Both of those prongs need to be satisfied.
And that's the Harrison answer.
That's the Harrison answer.
That's the second part of the analysis.
And then after we decide whether or not his testimony can be considered, we go down to the harmless error analysis, kind of the general harmless error analysis, whether or not this error contributed to the verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. And then we can either include his testimony in that, depending on what happened with Harrison, or we can not consider his testimony, depending on what happens with the Harrison analysis.
Looking at the motion for reconsideration that was referenced by the Chief Justice, I read that, and it's rather cryptic, but I read it to mean that having addressed harmless error, that subsumes the analysis. We wouldn't get to harmless error unless we've already gone through the analysis, although we didn't explicitly state it. That's the way I read it, but perhaps I'm incorrect in reading it.
You know, it is a little cryptic. I'm not sure exactly what they meant by it, but I guess it kind of brings me back to grade school. When you're taking a math test, you have to show your work. Like, I can't really say whether or not or how they considered that issue if it's not written in the opinion. And it was a fairly lengthy opinion, and it wasn't addressed at all, but we do know that they did rely on Mr. Lemoyne's testimony when they made their harmless error decision.
Well, the state's brief, as I read it, views the Harrison Anson as a second step. First voluntary, then you go to Harrison Anson, and they say the prosecution and it's straight law out of Harrison Anson, bears the burden of demonstrating beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's trial testimony was not impelled by the wrongful admission of his illegally obtained police statement, and the defendant would have made, it's a two-step, would have made the same damaging testimony admissions. And then they talk about credibility and implausibility, and then they go on to say, Lemoyne does not ask this court to determine whether his trial testimony was impelled, because he adheres to his position that only the circuit court can make it. Now, here you say either one can make it. Is
right.
That right?
Okay. To be quite frank, I don't think I thought about it when I was writing the brief, because Anson refers to the circuit court making the decision.
Okay. And then the state says, because Lemoyne hasn't chosen to ask this court to make that determination, this court should decline to do so. So it's as if you forfeited or waived that here. But then the state goes on to say, nevertheless, if the court is to consider the issue, then they go on to say whether or not it was impelled. So do you want this court to make that decision?
Yes. If the court concludes that a reviewing court is able to make that decision, I would like the court to make that decision.
Do you think that we as a reviewing court can make that decision on this record?
I do. I mean, because it is a paper review and you can't bring in any extraneous evidence, I think this court is capable of making the decision based on the record because it is a paper review.
When would you say the police had probable cause to arrest the defendant?
I guess conceivably after the girl made the allegation, and certainly after she spoke with Detective McClure and made the allegation again, I guess at that point they probably would have probable cause to arrest. And I believe that's what Lieutenant Stoddard told LeMoyne during the interrogation, that they did have probable cause to arrest.
And was that probable cause strengthened in the interview with Detective McClure or not? Was the probable cause beefed up, strengthened by the defendant's interview with Detective McClure?
The beginning of the interview? I don't know that it was strengthened all that much because, I mean, at the beginning of the interview, he admitted that he was back in the backyard with Caitlin for about 5 minutes, so I guess he places himself there, so I guess that could strengthen probable cause a little bit, but I don't know that it was incredibly strengthened.
You don't argue that he was in custody and needed Miranda. That's not in this case.
No, the issue here is voluntariness.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Wellman.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state, which is the plaintiff respondent in this case. We would ask this court, first of all, to hold that Mr. LeMoyne's police statement was voluntary under the totality of the circumstances, that the police officer's statement to him that if we get the true story on you today, I'll see to it you don't spend the night in jail, okay, was not coercive or improper or egregious. There's nothing wrong with the police offering a benefit to the defendant in return for his cooperation or statement. His statement, his follow-up statement, if we don't lock you up tonight, it will give you time to call an attorney and get your ducks in a row, all right. Otherwise, you know, we can lock you up if we choose to do so. The defendant said, all right. Stoddard said, which kind of limits your ability of what you can get? And the defendant said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, you're not going to be able to make any phone calls or anything. That was not a threat to hold the defendant incommunicado. It was incomplete and inartful, perhaps. But certainly in context, where the defendant did have his cell, this was a non-custodial interview. Particularly if you watch the videotape, there's a lot of body language interaction, give and take, going back and forth, the defendant's interrupting sometimes. I mean, it's a real back and forth discussion, really, or conversation. And the defendant does receive a beep or something from his cell phone. And the officer invites him to answer it, and he says, oh, it's just a text message. I get a million of them stupid things a day. During the tape, you'll see that actually the officer has his cell phone out twice, too. At one point, he's standing there, I don't know what you call it, scrolling, I guess, through. And then another time, he actually gets a call, says into the phone, I'll have to call you back later, and then sets the cell phone down on the table. All of which is just to show that in contrast, he's just pointing out the reality that in contrast, and it's true, An unincarcerated person has 24/7 access to anyone they want to talk to anytime, as long as they want. And when you're incarcerated, you don't have that. Certainly, he did not tell the defendant in response to a question, if I want to talk to a lawyer, can I talk to a lawyer? No, you can't. I mean, there was nothing of that nature. So we don't believe that in context of the whole interview that those things made it coercive or involuntary, nor did the fact that Miranda warnings were not given, because Miranda was not required. And it's not improper to decline to do something that you're not required to do for the police. And his other statements that may have exaggerated the physical evidence actually didn't exaggerate it at that point, because the test results weren't in and he didn't know what they were going to show. The child had undergone a SANE exam, so that was truthful. And his statement, you know, we won't make a big production in the press, that was also, you know, that was certainly a benefit he could offer the defendant. There was nothing particularly coercive. Balanced against that police conduct, we had the defendant's personal characteristics. There was nothing particularly vulnerable about this defendant. There's absolutely no evidence that he was low-functioning intellectually, had any particular mental or physical disabilities. Certainly none are evident, none were found by the trial court. He didn't graduate from high school, but thousands of people don't graduate from high school, and they're perfectly capable and competent of dealing with life's issues, including being talked to by the police. He did have his high school equivalency. He had a good job. He was a truck driver. He went to truck driver school. His give and take with the officers, he exercised a lot of independence and control in that interview. Not only the thing with the cell phone, but at one point he asked that the female detective leave. He didn't want to talk about the sexual allegation by this child in front of this woman. And so he exercised that control. He said, you know, can she leave? I'm not comfortable with her. And she left. So he's exercising control over his immediate environment. And in fact, when she said, oh, no problem, I'll leave, you know, nope, it's fine with me, I don't care. He says to Lieutenant Stoddard, I'm comfortable with you. He knew Lieutenant Stoddard from previous contacts. In fact, when Lieutenant Stoddard walked in the room and Detective McClure introduced him, defendant's response to Stoddard was, yeah, I was in here talking to you recently. You know, I talked to you about, and we don't know exactly what the other incident was. Apparently, it wasn't a, you know, interrogation of him as a suspect, but he was familiar with Stoddard. So we don't have, certainly don't have anywhere close to the kind of coercive atmosphere or overbearing of the defendant's will that we had in Hoppe, where you have a hospitalized person who's having convulsions and DTs and hallucinating and, you know, was really in very, very bad physical and mental shape.
Why didn't the defendant ask for an attorney?
We don't know. He didn't testify. This is another little glitch in the procedurally in this case, is that the trial court and counsel agreed that the trial court would make the decision based on the videotape of the interview, and there would be no testimony taken. Then on the day that the court was to issue its ruling on the suppression motion, which was just days before trial, defense counsel had submitted a submission of argument on the legal issues, but also contained representations as to what the defendant would testify to if he testified. But he hadn't testified, and nobody wanted to delay the trial, nobody wanted to delay the suppression hearing at that point, which is understandable. You have a child sexual assault case that nobody wants to put off. And so that was agreed that the trial court would assume, for purposes of its decision, that the defendant would say the things that he said he would say. The only one that I think is really very relevant here is that he says he thought it would be like a traffic ticket and he would just have to pay money. He didn't say anything at all about counsel, or I thought if they put me in jail, I wouldn't be able to call my mom or counsel or anything. There's nothing on that line. The trial court then, in its findings, it looked to what the defendant said and said, I think that's unreasonable that he says he believed that. I'm not quite sure what we do with this at this point, because it's not really a appropriate for the trial court to have made a credibility finding in because there was not actual testimony, I suppose we could remand for the court to make have testimony and make a credibility finding at this point. On the other hand, it may just drop out because it's so apparent from the rest of the record. If you, the end of the tape, after he's made his admissions, there's this discussion of, well, what happens now? And more talk about it being a felony and what the penalty of that could include jail. And he says, so I'm going to jail. There's no hint that he's at all surprised by that, that he thinks, I would never, you told me I wouldn't go to jail. I would never have said anything if I thought I would go to jail. No, he's asking questions about, are you, can I hunt? If I get convicted, if this is a felony, can I hunt? Can I fish? Am I going to be on that list that they have, which I assume he means the sex offender registration list? Are you sure I'm not going to lose my truck driver's license? That was very important to him. He had the perception, his own personal perception based on something that was said in truck driving school, that if he got a felony conviction, he wouldn't be able to drive truck anymore. So it's, you know, there's really, if you look at the whole package, take it out of context, in isolation, you could say, well, a person could think that he was threatening that if we lock you up, you know, you're locked up, nobody can talk to you, you can't talk to anybody, who knows when you'll next see a live person that you can talk to. I mean, it just sounds worse when you look at it in the whole context. Especially given his characteristics of not being particularly vulnerable, we believe that the statement was voluntary. If so, then we can, we don't have to deal with these other fascinating issues. But if it is involuntary and should not have been admitted, then we have to deal with the harmless error issue. And it's our position that because the Harrison-Anson analysis is a paper review, and it's ultimately a question of law whether the state demonstrated beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant would have testified anyway and would have made the same damaging admissions at trial, even if the statements had been excluded, that that's a question of law that the appellate court is perfectly, or and this court are perfectly capable of deciding.
We start with the premise that Anson said this is a paper review, but sure doesn't smell and sound like a paper review. When you have a question that would have testified anyway, or the two questions that you ask, that plugs into, in part, the constitutional question framework of analysis, historical and as a matter of law. Historical facts I'm talking about. Sure. I'm using shorthand. And it seems to me there's been no determination on these two questions, which in part beg for credibility determinations. I mean, oftentimes you're going to have a testimony, I suppose, the defendant would say, I wouldn't have testified, but, you know, that might be incredible. There might be other information that would support that. And so it seems to me that these two questions are, in essence, questions of fact, of historical fact, part of the two-prong analysis for a constitutional question. And yet we have Anson that says, no, it's paper review.
Right, and you know, Anson didn't really, as I recall, Anson, they didn't really discuss how they got there. I think part of the concern is that it would be so obviously an after the fact, after the, you know, the horses out of the barn, testimony and determination. And to me, it makes sense in the sense that it's really, it's like harmless error. In a sense, in harmless error, we're looking at, well, based on what we do know, what would have happened if this hadn't, you know, absent this error, would a rational jury have returned the same verdict? Or did this error contribute to the verdict? And, you know, you could call, I mean, in theory, one could say, well, you could call all the jurors in. That's how you could do harmless error. You could have the jurors come in and testify. If you had never heard this confession, would you have returned the same verdict? But we don't do that because it's after the fact. So I think it's because it's part and parcel of the harmless error analysis, it's appropriate to say, you know, we look at what we have. And granted, you know, it's a very difficult burden for the state. But looking at what we have, looking at what he said in his testimony, and, you know, arguments, I think, are as solid as we're going to have in this kind of a case, that he basically, there's no indication that he had any other defense. If he didn't give them some story about accident, there was really nothing to challenge this child's testimony. Unlike some cases where the defendant really does have, you know, at least a plausible, you know, defense he can put forward that the girl has some motive to lie, or that the mom is putting the child up to it because, you know, they were boyfriend and girlfriend and now they broke up and she's, you know, angry or they're in a custody battle. I mean, there's lots of other ways we see child sexual assault cases defended, and the defendant didn't have any of those routes of, you know, apparently didn't feel like they were strong enough to be available. You know, we do think it's appropriate to do the Harrison-Anson analysis, you know, up front and discuss it on, you know, that's our criticism of the Court of Appeals, with all due respect, is that they probably should, if they were going to say, you know, we look at Harrison and we are saying it's harmless because we found that it was not impelled. I read their motion for reconsideration decision. That's how I read it. And maybe I'm wrong. That they say we have already addressed and rejected it by holding it harmless. I took that to mean, well, we didn't say it directly, but implicitly we looked at Harrison and found it was not impelled. And because it was not impelled, we can use it to say that the error was harmless.
Even though it was never raised by counsel and never referred to in the
right,
case.
Right. And, you know, in the Court of Appeals in briefing, in the Court of Appeals, what defense counsel said was that, she, you know, she made a voluntariness argument, and then she said the error was not harmless. And then she said it couldn't even have been used to impeach him because an involuntary statement can't be used to impeach. So we didn't apparently read that to mean that she was challenging his testimony, that she was making a Harrison analysis. Nonetheless, I guess an exercise of extreme caution, rather than addressing that issue, the attorney who briefed it in the Court of Appeals is, unfortunately for all of us, now retired, Jim Freimuth, elected to just do harmless error without the testimony. He didn't rely on it, and probably an abundance of caution. So the trial court, I mean, to be fair to the Court of Appeals, the parties haven't laid it out there either. The preferable way, I would think, would be we should put everyone on notice. Defense counsel, if you're challenging a confession and the defendant also testified and made the same damaging admissions at trial, and you think that his testimony was fruit of the poisonous tree, you need to say that. And then the state's on notice that it needs to present its argument, if it can, that it was not impelled, and therefore you can consider the testimony.
And the burden is on the state beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, that's what Harrison says.
That's a tough burden.
It's a very tough burden, far tougher than the burden on involuntariness itself, which is interesting. But again, I think that comes up partly because it's part and parcel of the harmless error, and we have the burden on harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, when I asked a question regarding is this an historical fact and suggesting that that maybe there was a lack of comfort with Anson making the statement, it's a paper review, carte blanche. Your response in part was, well, under the facts of this case, you didn't have much of a defense anyway. Is Anson to be a carte blanche under cases where there really is a defense? Carte blanche, it's only a paper review. Is there any room for factual determination by a circuit court as to whether or not he would have testified anyway?
You know, I don't know. I didn't, because Anson it says what it says, and Harrison itself, and Harrison is a slightly different fact situation, which is a little confusing too, but Harrison itself, the Supreme Court just decided and held against the state. And in Maloney, this court just looked at what it had, which would have been the record, and said, well, we don't think it wasn't. His testimony was impelled. He would have testified anyway. I've not done any research and looked at whether there are other places, other courts that have held there's an exception, that sometimes it's an evidentiary hearing. So I guess before committing myself to whether there could be an exception and what it would look like and when it would come into play, I'd want to ask for a rebriefing on that. It makes sense to me that it's a paper review because harmless error is, and it's a piece. It's like the first step in the harmless error analysis when you have this fact situation. And I certainly am inclined not to suggest that we open up harmless error analysis to be an after-the-fact evidentiary.
You know, in part, it's, you know, we engage in these legal fictions, and when you suggest maybe in a harmless error, the analysis would say we don't call the jury in. Oh, I kind of shudder. I don't want to call the jury in as we engage in harmless error analysis. But the idea of calling the defendant or that isn't unusual for us. And, you know, it is a la Bangert or other kinds of evidentiary hearings.
It does come up in some circumstances.
Yeah.
That's true.
My
recollection is Anson was very complicated on some other procedural issues, including, I believe, in fact, I'm sure now that I think about it, at some point in Anson, it was the state that was arguing that it was a violation of the defendant's rights to have him testify about what he would have done and perhaps his conversations with counsel. So there was, I don't think that actually got decided. So I don't think Anson really focused on this issue is all I'm really trying to say.
But just take me through the steps. So you hold, to get to the harmless error, you have to hold it was involuntary.
Right.
Then the next step is the Harrison-Anson. And suppose the state meets its burden, right?
Right.
Then you never get to harmless error?
No, it would just be part of the harmless error analysis, where you could use his testimony to help demonstrate that, well, it's another factor, factor in the strength of the state's case and the importance of the error if the defendant's testimony provided another reason that, you know, for the jury to convict.
Well, let's just take me through that. The prosecution bears the burden that there's beyond a reasonable doubt that the trial testimony was not impelled and that the defendant would have made the same damaging testimony, right? So the state meets its burden. It's not impelled. He would have made the same damaging testimony. It's still involuntary.
Right.
Okay. So then you get to harmless error. So how does the harmless error apply?
Well, in the harmless error, in theory at least, this is a little unusual too, because the defendant didn't make exactly the same damaging admissions. He didn't say on the witness stand the same thing he told the police. He admitted that he touched the child's private part with his hand, but he said it was just momentary. I just picked her up and set her down. He didn't admit to the rubbing and all of that. So I still think we have to do the Harrison analysis, because I think if he told a different story but it was impelled, if it was a poisonous fruit of his involuntary confession, I think we still wouldn't be able to use it to our advantage. So but it makes it a little different. Normally what you do is you would have the two statements and say, well, if he made all of the same admissions in his testimony, then the jury could have relied on that, and that makes the erroneously admitted confession less important, less a contributing factor in addition to the other evidence that corroborated it. Here, it's not as strong of an argument because he gave an accident theory. So it doesn't really strengthen the state's harmless error argument as much as it might in some context, but that's what you would do. Is you would just look at the testimony like you do the child's testimony, the mother's testimony, the same nurse's testimony, and not just say, well, was that evidence sufficient? Because that isn't a harmless error argument. But is the strength of that evidence such, and the fact that it corroborates, each piece corroborates the other so strong, that in light of that, we can say that the confession didn't contribute to the verdict. And granted, in confession cases, you know, that's going to be one of your tougher harmless error arguments. We acknowledge that. But that's not to say it cannot be harmless error.
All right. So I'm going to change the fact situation. And we have it's involuntary. We then take the second step of Harrison Anson, and the prosecution doesn't meet the burden. And the finding has to be that the defendant's trial testimony was impelled by the wrongful admission, and the defendant would not have made the same statements, right?
Right.
Okay. So what's the harmless error now?
Then we can still do a harmless error analysis, but the state has the burden to show that the error...
State always has the burden to show,
right,
in this case, that it's harmless error.
Right.
Because they got advantage of the involuntary statement.
Right. It was
okay.
Trial court error as opposed to ineffective assistance, for example.
Right.
So the state then would have the even heavier burden, of course, of showing that the error in admitting the involuntary statement and the, quote, error in admitting his testimony. It's a little awkward way to phrase it that way, but his testimony should not have been heard by the jury either. So we'd have to show that both of those, that combination, was harmless error. So it doesn't mean that you would just stop doing, it isn't harmless per se if you have impelled testimony, but obviously that fact situation is going to be a more difficult case for the state.
You have because in effect you have a confession being brought in, and it would be hard to say that a confession didn't contribute to the verdict.
It is certainly more difficult than some other kinds of error. That's not to say it can't be, though, because, you know, first of all, there are confessions and then there are confessions. And a confession where the defendant is supplying a missing element, for example, or the defendant, if suppose you have a real question, I think in this case, the real question is, what happened? But if you have a real question whether, you know, where you have people who are identifying people who, you know, did the shooting and then ran off, and there's lots of circumstantial evidence against the defendant, but no direct evidence, then a confession would arguably be much harder to show that it didn't contribute to the verdict because it's providing a missing link. Here, the confession corroborated the child's story, but it didn't really provide any missing evidence that the jury would have, you know, needed to find a guilty verdict, or it didn't strengthen it to the extent that a full-blown, detailed confession where you think this guy had to be there and had to have done it or he couldn't be telling us all of this. I mean, there are some confession cases that are harder than others, just like other kinds of errors. There are some that it's more difficult to show other crimes evidence was harmful, depending on the nature of it, than others.
It seems to me you're applying the same harmless error test whether the state met its burden in Harrison Anson. I don't hear a difference.
Right. It's not a different test.
So if I don't hear a difference, in regardless of whether the state met its burden in Harrison Anson, why don't I just say it's irrelevant and I go right to harmless error? I know analytically I like that because it makes sense to me on the basis of the prior cases. But on the basis of what I hear, which doesn't necessarily mean I heard you right, it doesn't make one iota of difference whether the state meets its burden under Harrison Anson. You still have the harmless error test of did the defendant's statements contribute to the verdict.
Maybe I'm not following, but it seems to me it would make a difference. Well, it certainly would make a difference if you found that his testimony was not impelled, because then the state could use it to show that the error was harmless. I mean, that's basically how Hansen and Ayers.
How do you show that? You could use his statement, which is involuntary, right?
The
involuntary statement to show not harmless. How do you do
no,
that?
I'm sorry, I may have misstated it. You would use his trial testimony, which was not a poisonous fruit because it was not impelled. If you find he would have testified anyways, then you could say, well, based on everything he told the jury, it was harmless because they got two confessions. One of them's good, one of them's not.
The difference difference is you can use his trial testimony if it's not imperiled. You can't use his trial testimony if it is imperiled.
Right.
That makes sense to me.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I didn't hear you correctly.
Okay. I also just wanted to point again to, there was an issue raised in terms of defense counsel said that we know exactly, for sure in this case, we know that the jury considered or that the police statement, the confession, contributed to the verdict because the jury came back and asked about it. And I don't think it's appropriate to draw the inference necessarily that that means it contributed to the verdict. Obviously, the jury had some question about or they wanted to hear something again or see something again. But we have no way of knowing what that was and whether it was significant in the whole picture. So while it's an objective factor that you can say, yes, the jury had a question, yes, the jury deliberated, 10 days versus 5 minutes, those are facts that are in the record. I think you have to be very careful about drawing the inference that that necessarily means it contributed to the verdict. And I sort of I like the way Chapman talks about what has contributed to the verdict mean in application, and we quote it in our brief, I think at page 33, where they say, in the Chapman case, and that was the one where they had the Griffin comments on right to not to testify, where they said, well, the defendant didn't testify over and over, and the trial court instructed the jury they could consider that against the defendant, which was all unconstitutional, that they said, well, a reasonable, fair-minded jury might well have returned a not guilty verdict, absent the errors. And because of that, we can't say that those errors didn't contribute. And it seems to me that that may be one of the to me at least, it's one of the clearer ways that kind of helps conceptualize what does this mean. Did it make the difference? Was it significant? Or was the evidence not just sufficient, but so strong, and did it interact in a way? And did the confession really supply something important, or did it seriously undercut or not undercut the state's other evidence so that we can say, in light of the entire picture, the erroneously admitted error was insignificant in the causing the result?
Could I ask, why do you think, if your voluntariness case was as strong as you portray it, why do you think the Court of Appeals jumped over that and went to harmless error?
I don't know. Things change so much between the trial court level and the appellate level and this court. At the trial court, the defense, as I read their trial court pleadings, they were really pressing for a bright line rule that anytime you make a promise, anytime the police make a promise that they won't put the defendant in jail, that's per se involuntary. And they were really pushing for that, and we don't have case law, we don't believe that's correct, and we certainly don't have any case law in Wisconsin that holds that. I don't know if the Court of Appeals perhaps didn't want to go down that road and didn't want to. I don't know. I guess I'll just have to say I don't know.
This is at least the second state brief, and I'm sorry I can't remember the first, but at least the second, in which, and you may have written the first brief, in which the state takes the position that Harvey, Nader, and Chapman are all really one test, the same test. And that Harvey Nader just stated it somewhat differently, but that Harvey Nader adopted and reaffirmed the Chapman test, didn't abandon it.
Right.
And the essence of the test, this is how I read your brief, but if I'm wrong, you should tell me. The essence of the test is that the court concludes beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury would have found the defendant guilty absent the error. And then on 39, the critical determination is whether it appears, this is on your brief, third full paragraph, whether it appears beyond a reasonable doubt that the improperly admitted evidence did not contribute, that is, it did not make the difference in the verdict rendered. Mm-hmm. That's the state's position?
Yes, my understanding of Weed, which we quote at some point in our brief, is that Weed adopted
Weed is at page 33.
Yes, thank you, that Weed adopted, I did argue that position in Weed, actually, and that Weed adopted that position, that it's not different tests. It's two ways of saying the same thing, and I think maybe the proof is in the pudding. Our position is, whichever way you formulate, you ought to reach the same result under either test. And if you don't, then, there's something wrong, because then they, arguably would be different tests. But to me, it's just, some people find it easier to wrap their mind around saying, well, a rational jury would have returned the same verdict. But I guess the key point for this case, given how the defendant challenged the Court of Appeals ruling, is that we're certainly not saying that under either test or any formulation, it's just a sufficiency of the evidence. I don't think that's what the Court of Appeals was doing, but to the extent there's a perception out there that they are, that would not be correct to do that.
That's the danger in stating a harmless error test different from the contribute to the verdict, because then you're testing sufficiency, and that's not the test.
Yes, and it would certainly behoove the court if you reach harmless error to make that clear again, although we have made it clear in previous cases, but it certainly would bear repeating.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. York?
I just wanted to briefly touch on harmless error. I just wanted to make it clear that the involuntary statement here was pervasive throughout the trial. They talked about it in opening. They talked about it in closing. They talked about it throughout Stoddard's testimony.
Oh,
Lemoyne talked about it.
Excuse me. Ms. Nodoff, would you change the light system, please?
I'll make it
Thank
brief.
You.
So it was pervasive, and this is shown by the jury's questions. Of course, we don't know exactly what the jury was thinking, but the fact that they only asked about this piece of evidence, that's pretty damning evidence. And the court has to make a decision beyond a reasonable doubt whether or not this evidence contributed to the verdict. To say that it did not contribute to the verdict, when that's the one thing the jury was concerned about when they were deliberating, I think it's a very difficult case to make.
Counsel, you are asking us to find, first of all, that the statement was involuntary, so it was coerced. Secondly, that it fails under the Harrison-Anson test. Thirdly, that it is not harmless error, correct?
Correct.
If we do that, then what you're requesting us to do is to remand it back to the circuit court for a new trial where he will not testify, correct?
No, I believe that he can make that decision with his new counsel whether or not he would testify. Harrison-Anson is not only he wouldn't testify, it's also he would not have testified in the same way. I don't think by asking the court to make a Harrison determination now, that means that if he does get a new trial, he's prohibited from testifying. The reality of the situation is when a confession is used against him, it kind of taints the whole way the defense attorney will look at the case.
Okay, so let's just say he does testify. I had thought you were going to have him not testify. But let's just say that he goes back for a new trial, and he does testify, and he testifies inconsistent with the video recording of his statements to the officer. Maybe he testifies, he never went in the backyard at all, he simply wasn't there, or in the backyard. He never touched the child or any part of the child's body. Can the state then use the video recorded statements to impeach him based on credibility?
No, because the state...
So he gets a pass on whether he was credible when he talked to the officer or whether he was credible when he's testifying. You can't challenge his credibility based on prior statements.
They cannot use the involuntary statement against him. They could use the beginning of the interrogation, and during the beginning of the interrogation, he does say that he was in the backyard, but I believe that they cannot use his involuntary statement to impeach him.
Okay, and what case do you rely on for that proposition?
Your Honor, I actually don't have that with me right now,
right,
but
I can
provide
it
to the court.
I can have my clerk look at that.
Thank you.
Did the jury hear the entire tape of the questioning of the defendant by the police, or only the part of confession? Did they hear the promises made or the...
Yes, I believe during trial they saw the entire interrogation, and then when they asked for the interrogation the first time during deliberations, they showed the part where Stoddard, it was just Stoddard and LeMoyne in the interrogation up until, I believe, about 100, page 100 of the transcript. And then the second time during deliberations, they showed just the portion where LeMoyne was talking about her being on his lap. And I believe in the record it says exactly what pages they showed from the transcript. If the court doesn't have any...
Is the defendant presently incarcerated?
He will be out in about 2 weeks.
Are you asking, in effect, for a new trial, or what are you really asking?
Yes, for a new trial where the state could not use the involuntary statement against him.
Inasmuch as he's served his whole sentence in prison, do you think there's a likelihood of a new trial?
I guess that would be a question for the state. I mean, obviously we wouldn't want to have another trial, but if the state wanted to go forward, I guess that's up to the state.
Thank you.
No further questions. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. York, and thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments in yet another case involving confessions, but no Miranda issue here. That's a surprise. And thank you for your briefs and your oral argument. That ends our argument in 10 AP 2597 CR State versus LeMoyne. The court will take a short recess for counsel and audience to clear, if they want to clear, and then we'll hear our second case. We are in recess.